In this part of the program, we are live in our television studio with an audience. We want to say welcome to them and also welcome to our special guest, Kevin Close. He is the president and chief executive officer of National Public Radio. Before going to work at NPR, he served as director of U.S. International Broadcasting, overseeing the government's global radio and television news services. He was president of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. Before that, he was an editor and reporter at the Washington Post. He was there for 25 years. He was city editor, Moscow bureau chief, a Midwest correspondent, deputy national editor. He is the author of a book, Russia and the Russians, Inside the Closed Society. He's the co-author of four others. And this morning, we'll be talking about the future of public radio. And we're happy to have questions from people who are listening, people here in the audience, people at home. 333-9455, as always, toll-free, anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much.
I'm delighted to be here.
The figure that I have now seen in print for the public radio audience, 15 million, we think maybe it might actually be a few million more than that. But I think those of us who work in public radio have always had this feeling that it could be and should be bigger. How big could it be? What do you think the potential is?
I think the potential is substantially larger than we are now. In the 2 years I've been at NPR, the national audience, the CUME, which is the sort of gauge of weekly listenership, has risen from 13 to 15 million. I believe that we can make it a lot larger by being smarter about how we present ourselves to the democracy, and that means looking for new kinds of programming to reach new audiences. We've done some focus groups quite in depth and found we focused on people who don't listen to NPR programming into their local stations and asked them, why don't you? And we played for them the kinds of programming that we do. And the answer has come back, I should be listening to this. I don't listen to you because I don't know you're there. Over the 31-year history of NPR, we've had very little money to spend on promotion and for reaching out to audiences. Most people listen to us by hear of us by word of mouth, or because they sort of wander down to the left-hand end of the FM dial. So we are looking at ways we can, with stations, create some specific targeted outreach to audiences that don't listen. In essence, those people who do listen to us are a broad cross-section of Americans. The one sort of qualifier is people who have had college education of some kind or other, and also who are engaged in the activities of their communities. Those are the two sort of broad qualifiers. Yeah.
One thing I think we know is that we don't have a lot of people listening who are, say, much under 25. Maybe not a lot of people listening who are under 30. That seems to be an audience that we have a hard time reaching. Is there something that we could be doing to attract younger people to listen?
Yes, we believe strongly at NPR and in dialogues with our member stations, of which there are 300, that we can create programming which will be of interest to an audience that is younger. To some degree, in public radio, all of us face the same issues that the print media, that newspapers face, which is newspapers are scrambling to figure out who under the age of 30 wants to read them. They have enormous drop-off in readership of people below the age of 30. Our issue is that our general demographic for the average listener in the United States is the age group is about age 42 to 44. So we are thinking about, and we have created actually some programming that's targeted at an audience that takes its information slightly differently than the way we've presented it over the 30 years of, for example, All Things Considered and the 21 years of Morning Edition. We've created a new program called The Way In, which is just sort of in pilot right now. It's a one-hour news magazine that's pulsed a little bit quicker with a slightly more intimate sound than Morning Edition. And we're sort of working through to see whether we like how it sounds. And we will have member stations help us in the listener side of it to hear whether it has that pulse and that sort of format that we think might be attractive to the 25 and in that age segment.
This morning here on Focus 580, we're talking with Kevin Close. He's president and CEO of National Public Radio. And questions are welcome. We have someone ready to go on the phone. And again, here for people who are in the audience, questions welcome, too. All you have to do is give us a wave and we'll get somebody over to the mic, to you with a microphone. First, let's take a caller here on our line number four. The caller is in Aurora. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning, and welcome, Kevin Close. I think your programming is wonderful here in Illinois, and I guess I fit into those categories you suggest. I'm well over 30.
College, so am I.
College and into activities, an RN. So, but what my question was this. Every time my sister comes to visit, and she just left about 2 weeks ago, she just raves about the programming on WILL. But she lives in New York City, and she says the programming is not as good in New York. Why would that be?
Let me say, before I answer the question, that we have a great member station in New York, WNYC.
WNYC, okay.
Yeah. Okay, next question.
Well, I just, like I said, I just rave about WILL. I tell all my friends about your programming, and if, you know, and I tell them what it's on 580, et cetera, et cetera. I couldn't live without it, and thank you much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And on behalf of our New York audiences, thank you very much, too.
Yeah, don't worry. They can't hear you. Well, other calls are questions welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Here's somebody else. Champaign County, line one. Hello?
Listening on real audio, so maybe they are keeping track.
It is. Well, yes, that's true. And, you know, now that we're on the web, people in New York could be listening.
Yes, and people in Kazakhstan and in Karachi and in very, very far places. And the web is enormously important to the future of WILL. And the University of Illinois.
Anyway, we cut in on you. What's
okay, I invited it, I guess. I'm concerned about the funding. I know that there's a big emphasis on listener-funded, but I think it's the obligation of a federal government to fund, and I don't like what I've seen over the past with CPB. I actually don't know what the current status of the mechanism for funding, whether there's there was always the talk about having a three-year forward cycle funding so that there would be some isolation of political influence on content. Well, I'm rather unhappy. I think that there are a lot of good things that WLL does locally, but I think at the NPR level and at the nationwide level, I'm rather unsatisfied with the reporting vis-a-vis maybe foreign affairs issues, corporations. I see it's pernicious that ADM and another quasi-corporation like the Emirate of Kuwait are funding NPR, and I think that I actually have a suggestion for a different sort of funding structure. I think this is obviously going against the current because the other examples we have from Europe are kind of going the other way, but they have taxes that are you know, more fixed and can't be like licensing fees for receivers and that sort of thing. I'm not suggesting that here, but I do have a suggestion. But I really see that there's been a self-censorship going on at NPR. There's been a chilling effect. I guess that's the term they use in the J schools because of maybe these struggles. And frankly, I guess I see your Inside the Beltway, Washington Post, USIA connection as being maybe one of the solutions that's been done. I think that I don't expect you to take that sympathetically. I see that as a very negative part of the phenomenon. So
let's
I have a right of reply here, I guess.
You made several points, and let's let's give the guest a chance to respond.
Let me say that the issue of funding is very important to us, and we do receive an amount of federal support directly. Our budget this year will be about $100 million at NPR. We spend close to half of that on news gathering and production. Just to take the budget piece of it, we have direct federal funding of anywhere in any typical year of between $1 million and $3 million of that $100 million. It's very, very small. When NPR started 31 years ago, it was 100% federally supported. Over the years, the Congress has moved it from federal support to community-based and based on foundation and corporate underwriting. And they've been very insistent that we find means other than federal tax dollars to support what we do.
Where are you counting CPB in that?
CPB, we apply to CPB for project grants in a competitive environment with the PRI and other producers, both independent and stations, of new kinds of programming. And we also receive some federal support through the National Science Foundation for our science and health coverage and from the National Endowment for the Humanities for some of our cultural presentations.
Well, there's a lot there, and I'll let some of it hang in the air, but I think that we could creatively, this is a modest proposal because I don't expect it'll go anywhere soon, is have an advertising tax where commercial media are taxed at some rate of what they spend on advertising. Rather than it being a tax write-off, I think it should be taxed, and as, you know, this is a way of recouping the public aspect of the airwaves, and that some fraction of that should be fixed and sent to different sorts of public things, including, you know, low-power FM, which is another story, and I'm sure you'll probably get a call on that. But I'm afraid I do question your credentials. The Washington Post, for the longest time, has had Walter Pincus, an ex-agent or asset of the CIA, covering intelligence issues, and I guess that's a bit of a digression, but if you were 30 years there, you're intimately involved with it. I just see you as just too much inside Washington and too... You know, people aren't going to tell you that they're censoring their stories. Self-censorship is the problem in commercial media as well. So I'll let someone else have a chance.
Yeah, we do have somebody else waiting here, and I want to promise them, and we'll get right to them in a minute. I would like to follow up on one thing that the caller asked, and you may indeed want to make further response. Maybe I'll let you do that first.
Well, I'd like to say on the issue of so-called self-censorship, the news operation at NPR is a courageous, smart, independent news enterprise. It is run by qualified journalists who were both in public radio and in the print media, and we take a backseat to nobody in proving our independence and our credibility and our integrity every day of the year. With regard to foreign coverage, our foreign coverage is extensive. We're the only American network, and this is what's extraordinary about NPR and its member stations. We're the only American network whose foreign coverage is actually expanding. We're doing more foreign coverage. We've expanded our foreign bureaus. We now have 11, thanks to the voluntary support of listeners to their local stations and to foundation support, and also to corporate underwriting. And the corporate underwriting has never influenced the news enterprise any more than it would in any other credible presenter of daily information and high-quality news and information. With regard to our foreign coverage, let me just finally say, we have an ambitious series coming forward through the year on globalization, which is very important. We're going to take our microphones to the far places of the world where to look at the issues involved in the engagement of global enterprises and third world and fourth world countries to see what the impacts are and what the social and economic realities are.
Yeah. We, over the years, certainly have gotten comments from people about our underwriting. There are people who would wish that we had less. There are people who say, it's a commercial. I don't care what you call it. That's what it is. But, you know, not a lot. I guess I cannot remember quite the reaction that I have heard from people to NPR's current underwriting from the government of Kuwait. And I have to confess that was one that when I heard, I thought, gosh, couldn't you have passed this one by? What was the thinking on that? And now, looking back on it, would you say maybe we should have passed it by?
Well, I should say your the first criticism of this decision came from NPR's ombudsman, and you can see it on our website at npr.org, where Jeffrey Dvorkin, who is the first ombudsman to represent the public's interest and public questions and public criticism about NPR and to explain NPR to our listeners. On our website, wrote a column, which he writes on a regular basis, criticizing the decision and saying he didn't think we should make it. Our underwriting rules and regulations are very carefully drawn to allow both us to exercise the full rights of free speech, but also to recognize when we have the right to say, no, we don't want that underwriting. We looked at the Kuwait underwriting credit very carefully. We had a lot of debate at NPR management. 2 years ago, we had an underwriting credit very similar from the Federal Republic of Germany, celebrating the 10th anniversary of the demise of the Berlin Wall, and we felt that this was in the same vein. We have received a substantial amount of criticism, and I will tell you that we will reconsider going forward what are all the parameters of our underwriting processes and policies.
Our guest this morning, Kevin Close. He's president and CEO of National Public Radio. We have several people on hold. We'll try to get in as many as we can. Again, for our audience here, if there are people who would like to ask a question, we'd certainly be happy to take one. We'll do that. We'll go to an audience member.
Hi, my name is Mary Ellen Page, and I am here via Phoenix, Arizona. And I listen to K-Jazz in Phoenix, and I'm surprised by the total lack of local programming before 6 o'clock in the evening. And I was just wondering, I actually enjoy the news programming on K-Jazz. They run Public Interest and Diane Rehm and Talk of the Nation. But I was just wondering, does NPR promote local stations to do more local programming, or do they want their stations to do more national programming?
Hey, what can I tell you? It's a 60s collaborative.
Right.
You know, every station and program director and station manager makes decisions on what they're going to put on the air based on how they best understand they can serve the interests of their community. And in Phoenix, for example, there are two stations there, K-Jazz and K-Bock, and they're formatted differently. They're very similar to WILL AM and FM, which are formatted quite differently.
And they have the same station manager as well, I believe.
Yes, and it's similar to here.
Right.
So, you know, if you're in the Phoenix area and you want them to change their programming or to take in different kinds of programming, write them or call them. We don't have any real say-so. We present to the stations what the quality of the programming is, and it's up to them to decide what they want to take.
Let's get back to the phones. I have somebody who's been patient and in Champaign. Line 2. Go ahead.
Yes, it's sort of interesting. Well, it's very interesting. I turned on the program to ask a question about the underwriting by Kuwait, and then there was all this discussion about it. But the discussion actually didn't go quite deep enough for me. I actually called WILL to withdraw my support after 15 years because I was so deeply offended by that. I've been offended by the increased corporate sponsorship because some of the corporations that do sponsor programs are so inappropriate. When you have major polluters supporting nature and things like that, and I've bit my tongue, you know, not really, you know, not said anything. But when the Emirate of Kuwait underwriting came on, that was a political statement. That was a political statement that said that this war was good, that this incineration of Iraqis was good, that this continued starvation of Iraqis was good. And I demonstrated against that war with my infant on my back. And I was happy to see it disappear. I was talked into not withdrawing my support until this program, until I could hear what you had to say, and then I haven't heard it again on the local station. And I do not think that political advertisements, or whatever you want to call them, belong on this station. I actually don't think that large corporation underwriting belongs on this station or in NPR. And I know it costs money, but to sleep with the devil to get your job done is bad, in my opinion. So I would like to know if you if you are going to support more political underwriting.
Well, let me first make a comment. I appreciate hearing your views. I would say that if you're opposed to corporate underwriting and opposed to other kinds of underwriting, then perhaps you should not withdraw your support of the station, but actually help support the station, because we by the nature of the laws passed by the Congress have been encouraged to do corporate underwriting and to find underwriting that is that represents the wide place in this democracy for free speech. I would like to say about the Kuwait underwriting credit that whether you agreed or disagreed with what happened in 1991, the facts are that there was some kind of an invasion of what was a sovereign entity that was not Iraq, and that there were changes forced on those people, and there were interventions at an international level, and the Kuwait underwriting credit pays tribute to what happened 10 years ago. It's an event you may not agree with, but there it is.
Well, sure it happened. There are a lot of things that happen of a political nature, but I just don't think that belongs there at all. And as far as my increasing my support, I support as much as I can, and I have for a very long time, but I'm not a rich person, but that has nothing to do with whether you should have Cargill or Exxon or other corporations underwriting your programs, especially, I don't know if Exxon still supports nature shows on the television side. But it's just incredulous to me to hear oil corporations funding nature. It's a lie. It allows those corporations to hide behind, to make hay out of a show on lions or conservation of wolves or whatever.
Yeah, I'm gonna jump in. I hope the caller will forgive me. We're already at the midpoint. I know I have other callers. I appreciate the points that you made, and I'd like to give some other people a chance to do the same. And I don't know if you want to say anything in addition to what you've already said.
I appreciate the exchange of views.
Our guest is Kevin Close. He's President, Chief Executive Officer of National Public Radio. You want to call in, talk with him. We do have about 25 minutes. I just encourage people to try to be brief just so that we can get in as many people as possible. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. And again, people who are here in the audience, I think we have someone else who'd like to ask a question.
Yeah, Mr. Close. So I'm one of your listeners, just still under 30. but my question regards low-power FM radio, which was basically been killed in Congress this last year. And you, as the president of NPR, went on record as very vociferously opposing this new service, which would have allowed – you're shaking your head already – would have allowed a lot of new small stations to go on the air. And My question regards the fact that these stations are a lot like some other stations already on the air called translators, which WILL has one at 101.1 FM, that operate basically under the same rules, basically the same technical guidelines, except they can't originate their own broadcasting. And my question is, why did NPR so vociferously speak out against this?
Yes, it's a good question, and I'd be happy to answer it. In fact, we believe, and have said so very, very strongly and very positively, that we believe low power FM, a new system that was proposed by the FCC and by its then chairman Bill Kennard, actually could be very complementary and compatible with our member stations. But we believed that there were unresolved technical issues, which have not to this day been resolved, arising from the potential for interference from the new transmitters to existing public radio stations, with specific regard to the way, for example, WILL reaches its translator stations. And it may apply here, but it certainly applies in the West. There are two specific issues. One had to do with what are known as radio reading services to the blind, which are carried on subcarriers by more than 100 of our member stations. Those subcarrier transmissions are extremely vulnerable to interference from nearby low power or any other interference, because the spectrum is whatever it is, it's a finite spectrum, and any additional transmission across any spectrum has the potential for raising raising interference issues. We asked the FCC to check whether there wouldn't be substantial or significant interference to the radio reading services for the blind on the subcarriers. FCC very reluctantly did some testing and has never made public what the results were of the testing as to whether the receivers used by people who are vision impaired, of which there are about 2 million listeners in the United States to these radio reading services. And these are very simple radio services provided mostly services by volunteers who read from the local newspapers what the supermarket specials are for people who can't get the information that way. They read what the bus schedules are and where polling places are. They're very, very important to people who can't receive information by sight. We never got a satisfactory answer to that, and we felt it was a major issue that had to be paid attention to by a public service commission such as the FCC. The second piece of it had to do with interference, electronic interference from low power transmitters to the very translators you're talking about, repeater stations that carry a main station signal to very remote areas. In the West and the Mountain West and in the Northwest, these repeater stations are very important to the distribution of NPR programming to isolated pockets and communities where there is no other radio or anything else. And we also asked them to make protections available to those translator systems, and we felt that the FCC was not responsive. Therefore, we had another way to redress our issues, and that was to go to a legislative solution. The legislative solution that is in place allows for the rollout of more than 100 LPFM stations in different places in the country and asks for independent testing to see whether interference to existing public radio stations will occur or not. And that's where we're at. I don't think that's a refusal to accept or a denial of LPFM. I do think that you don't try out something, you don't build a car and then put it on the highway without testing it out. And that's what I think FCC was trying to do.
Well, but as a follow-up to that, your translator stations are low-power stations, essentially. They're already existing out there. And so it sounds more like you're saying, well, our low-power stations are translators. They don't interfere because they're ours, but these other stations, we can't control them. They're a threat. They will cause interference.
The issue with the translators is that they're like a series Christmas tree lighting set. If you interdict, and they're linked, many of them, and I say it may not be at WILL, you may link by my microwave to your to your translators, but others use the subcarriers to make the inputs from the mother station out to the translators. That subcarrier is extremely susceptible to interference from low power. It is that piece that we were looking for protection on, and we didn't get it. If you interdict one in a sequence of, say, 7 or 8 translators, they all go down. That's why it's like a series lighting set. And so the damage to existing public service, nonprofit, community-based public radio by the indifference of the FCC to simple issues that we asked them to look at, which they refused to do, caused us to take a legislative route.
Why would the FCC be indifferent to that? You know,
the FCC, it's interesting. You know, I talked face-to-face with Kennard, and we had many direct meetings with FCC staff and many of the previous members of the previous FCC. And I will tell you that we did not reach a positive result with them. I think that it's in part is because Chairman Kennard, for his own reasons and their estimable reasons, wanted to get low power out the door very fast, and they were not willing to do the what I felt were realistic and rational testing before they put it on the highway.
Thanks for the question. Let's go back to somebody who is on the telephone listening. This is Urbana Line 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
In contrast to an earlier caller, I would have to say, and I've lived in many areas of this country, I would have to say that the local programming here is the worst that I have ever experienced.
Thank you very much.
With the exception of David. and one real complaint I have had and voiced to the program director was concerning listening to news about pork bellies. What is it, 10, 20 minutes on every hour? I'm not interested in pork bellies. I'm not interested in sport. And with the exception of David Inge, that seems to be about all there is on the local programming. When I have complained to the program director and asked for the address of the ombudsman. He told me that he has heard many complaints, similar complaints, and that it would do me no good to write to the ombudsman because he can schedule programming as he wants to. I had understood that this was National Public Radio. And another complaint I have is that I think there's no place for the thinly disguised Christian hour, which occurs on Sunday afternoon. I think there's no place on public television, public radio for that.
I'm not sure how to respond to questions about our own programming. I guess I would still direct anybody who had comments to our station manager, Dan Simeone, or our program director, Jay Pierce. I think one tends to overemphasize the presence of those things one doesn't like, because in most cases...
Well, 10 minutes, 20 minutes out of every hour.
Well, actually, as far as the markets are concerned, I think it's more like 5 minutes out of every hour, unless you count the places where we're doing the extended programming. I guess I would have to say that for a long, long time, this station has had a very strong commitment to provide this kind of information to a very significant segment of our audience, that is, people who are involved in agriculture. And in fact, over the years, I think the amount of airtime that we've spent has actually shrunk. There's not very much we can say to somebody to whom that doesn't mean anything other than we would appreciate your patience. And I think that if you would find something else to do for that 5 minutes and then come back, you would find it was very quick.
Well, I think 5 minutes
is too much. Well, for some people, yes, 5 minutes is too much. For some people, 2 minutes would be too much. Mr. Close here has no control over the amount of time we spend talking about pork bellies. So I don't know that he
and nothing to say about the merits of the debate either. I will say though, I spent 4 years in Chicago as Midwest bureau chief for the Washington Post, and part of the. Part of the fascination of covering the Midwest is that this is a place that has direct needs to know about such things as the latest price of pork bellies. I mean, there's a lot of people engaged in farming out here, and it's a very serious issue with them. It's what their lives are centered around. And as we become this global enterprise that the U.S. economy is, these issues are important to listeners. But I leave it to the judgment of the program director at WILL.
I want to ask you about something else, and then we'll take some other callers. And I hope people will forgive me if this seems to be too much of an in-house kind of question, something that people in public radio would think about. But here it is. I know that you've been spending a lot of time traveling around talking about new media, movement of NPR onto the Internet. I know that sometime soon there will be a satellite network launched to provide satellite radio to people in their cars, and NPR is going to be providing programming. Now someone, if they want to, can listen to NPR by going to NPR on the web. And as there are more and more ways for a program producer like NPR to distribute its programming, one might ask, what do you need us for?
Well, because our core, that's a fair question. The issue for us, all of us in public broadcasting, and in fact in all the media, is we didn't create these new platforms, satellite radio, the internet, the online space. The question is, are we going to be there or not as an intellectual and creative activity for the democracy? Because we can't determine how the citizens are going to come to their information, what sources of information they will use. For us, I believe that with our member stations, we need to be there powerfully, and we will be there in a series of identities. As NPR, as WILL, as other stations present themselves on their websites online, in the satellite radio services that we've created 2 24/7 channels on one of these new radio private radio satellite corporations called Sirius Satellite Radio. It's a kind of cable radio system. It's a subscription system. We've just gone live with these two channels. We don't know who's going to be listening to these new services. It may be people who are listening to local stations who will migrate just by nature to a different means of receiving their information. It may be people who have never listened to their local stations, and it may be people who don't listen to anything at all who will now come into these services. The issue is the democracy going to make use of that new platform, and should we be there? My belief is very powerfully yes. And I believe, in essence, what we're trying to do is to create once and play it everywhere. If we can do that, we will get economies of scale. We'll get reach intellectually and creatively, and reach into the way the democracy gets its information.
Well, and there are a number of stations now, public stations, that are webcasting. We're doing it. A lot of other people are doing it. I think there also is a strong feeling that it should not simply be taking what we are broadcasting and putting it out over the web. It ought to be more than that. Having said that, then, what is the more that it should be?
Well, we see the internet space as a very powerful place to present. First of all, radio is magic, in my estimation. I spent many years in print. I happen to have come out of a radio background. My parents were radio producers in the 30s and 40s, so I grew up around microphones. The reason radio is magic is because you can't see it, and because it can be with you wherever you are in your life. You can be jogging, you can be driving, you can be washing the dishes, you can be patting the dog, you can be comforting your child, and you can have the radio there with you. So it's a very intimate space. It's the only mass medium, in my estimation, that is a mass medium of the imagination, because you cannot see it. You can only imagine what the voices are telling you. And as Susan Stamberg has said, we do the best pictures in broadcasting on public radio. The issue for us is, how do you get that magic to another platform? For example, online space, which is looking for video presentation as well as text, as well as audio. We're trying to figure out how you come into that place to save the magic, protect it and strengthen it, but also reach into the new medium. We did a series, if I may, this is a slightly longer answer, but we did a series recently called Prison Diaries on All Things Considered. It was a series of segments by teenagers who are incarcerated. There is a website that matches the Teen Diary segments that's on All Things Considered. If you go to the website, what you will see is a visual presentation by Hockney-like assemblages of photographs, still photographs, of the environment that these children are living in. The interrogation rooms, the study rooms, the dormitory, whatever it is. It's there on the website. And as you look at the website, you can hear the audio coming down. So it expands the encounter. It doesn't interfere with the audio experience, but it augments it. We think that's where we can explore creatively the web space and bring something new to the public broadcasting community.
We just have about 10 minutes left in this part of the show. Kevin Close is our guest. He's president and CEO of National Public Radio. I want to try to get some more calls. Callers will help us by being brief, so please do that. We'd like to get in as many folks as we can. Let's go next to Taylorville, line 4.
Yes, I realize that as opposed to genuinely civilized countries like France and the Scandinavian entities, national public radio and television are working on a starvation budget, hence their corporate sponsors. But this is what really gripes me. I'm particularly concerned with your music programming, but I've got something to say about your other programming. For example, this fresh air thing, to me, it's been going downhill. It's more and more involved with pop and mass culture. But as regards music programming, it's really the classical equivalent of music's greatest hits. And your idea of daring, I remember one night in the wee small hours, I was listening to your FM outlet, and I heard something by some entity you clipped, Ignaz Bruhl, and I could understand after having heard it why I'd never heard of this character. That's your idea of daring. As regards 20th century music, there are major 20th century composers whose work you never hear on public radio. For example, Edgar Varèse, Luciano Berio, Luigi Nono, Dalla Piccola, Karlheinz Stockhausen, on and on. Here we are in the 21st century. And I would say in the last year, if I'd listened 24 hours a day, every day of the year, I doubt that I would have heard an hour's worth of music by all those people combined. And it just it exasperates me to the point that occasionally I feel like screaming.
Well, let's get a comment from our guest. I don't know how much you get involved in cultural program, music program.
Oh yes, NPR is the nation's premier presenter of classical and jazz music in the public radio system. And in December, National Public Radio was distinguished by the nation, by President Clinton, awarding us a National Medal of Arts for 30 years of excellence in presenting classical, jazz, presentations, folk, comedy, drama, and commentary on the cultural life of the democracy. We were very proud to receive that in recognition of 30 years of the kinds of presentations we do. Our premier classical show is called Performance Today. It's a two-hour, seven-day-a-week show, and it does the highest quality recording or live presentation of classical music in companionship with our member stations. We do a lot of field production with member stations, finding the best performances year-round, both America in America and abroad. And we are increasingly, we're very interested in modern music, and we don't hesitate to put it on the air. So I would just say to the listener, I thank you for your comments, and I'm very pleased to be able to say that that the recognition of NPR, I think, is well-deserved.
Let's go on. Next is Champagne, line number one. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I'll keep it very brief. I'm a longtime listener, longtime supporter of National Public Radio and our local station. I absolutely love the news coverage, listen to it quite frequently. I do want to agree in part with the first caller talking about self-censorship and the chilling effect. He brought up the cause of fundraising. I'm afraid that the cause of the change in news coverage over the last 8 years is more toward a fear of being labeled liberal media. I'm afraid, and in my opinion, that as I've watched NPR coverage over the last 8 years especially, NPR is bending over backwards with news coverage to appear not to be a quote-unquote liberal media. And I think that NPR is actually supporting conservative and or Republican tenets, principles, or ideas through the coverage by not challenging some of the things that the conservative school of thought has to say, and by underemphasizing some of the things that a more democratic or liberal school of thought has to say. And so I think that there's been a decided change because of the fear of appearing to be one of the quote-unquote liberal media. Now, it's true that NPR does carry some decidedly liberal shows, as the hour-long specials may be tucked away on a late evening or sometime in a weekend afternoon or something. But I'm talking about the mainstream news coverage of All Things Considered in Morning Edition, where the real news gets reported in an allegedly simple, straightforward way. I think there is where the bias has come in over the years, and I'd love to hear a response to that. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
I'm really appreciating the show. Again, love the programs, but I thought this was something that needs to be brought up.
Thanks for the call. It's something we've heard a lot from listeners. What do you think?
I don't dare suggest to Robert Siegel that he presents the news in a simple way. I think that our coverage is comprehensive. I think we are very responsive to trying to embrace the wide spectrum of political ideas and the dialogue in this country. And I will tell you, I'm neither conservative nor liberal when it comes to these issues. I'm trying to stay on the news and to make sure that our discussion and our commentary and our analysis is wide-ranging and intellectually curious and precocious. And that doesn't really have a political character to it. With regard to our reporting, you know, we are the recipient of many, many awards and prizes for the kinds of reportage we've done. Most recently, we received DuPont Columbia University gold medal for a special and a series that arose out of the special on the war crimes in Kosovo. I would tell you that NPR has been at the forefront of covering that issue and the rise of the issues of international human rights courts to judge and gauge issues of war crimes. We will stay on that story aggressively, looking at all the issues around that.
I think we'd do certainly one more, maybe more. Let's go to Urbana Line 2. Hello.
Yeah, I think you could learn something from this station and their call-in programs. They never stop anyone from airing their opinion. And it's wonderful, you know, they just take people in order, and I've never gotten that feeling from NPR on the national level, because I've never heard any kind of contrary or really disturbing point of view aired on NPR, so I kind of agree with a couple of previous callers, but I was, rather than just talk about self-censorship, I just wanted to ask you, would you go so far as to, I mean, we hear a lot of people say that a report that government people will tell the media, you know, don't air a particular person or story because it's in the best interest of the country. Would you go so far as to state bluntly that you don't cave into such suggestions? And can you give us an instance where that was where you didn't cave in to that kind of suggestion from people? So rather than self-censorship, I'm talking about more overt censorship.
Yeah, I'll give you about a minute.
In the 2 years and 2 months that I've been at NPR, we have not caved into such demands. But I will tell you as well, there have not been such demands. In my experience at the Washington Post, most of the time when there is an effort by the government to prevent publication or broadcast of a media report, it has to do with what are broadly considered to be or narrowly considered to be national security issues. And we have, at the Washington Post, we were criticized severely on many occasions for publishing things which various governments and administrations felt shouldn't be published and were not in the national interest, but we felt it was in the national interest for the public to know.
We're just about the point we're going to have to stop on. I have to apologize to anyone who is holding because we've used the time. We very sincerely at WILL care what you think about the programming. You can write us, you can call us. The people at NPR do feel the same. You can get in touch with him a variety of ways.
Yes, you can call me or write me, or better yet, talk to the ombudsman. But if you want to write me or send me an email, it's kklose, K-K-L-O-S-E, at npr.org. And our address in Washington by snail mail is NPR, 635 Massachusetts Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20001.
All right. Thanks very much. Our guest this morning, Kevin Close. He's president and CEO of National Public Radio.